best thing about 10 Radio is that it allows people from all walks of life to have a go at becoming a DJ. Take me, for example. I'm an astronaut.
10 Radio is good because everyone's allowed to join in.
Well, it's great. It has a way of bringing people together, and it's a lot of fun.
10 Radio is good because you don't know what to say.
I really like the fact that 10 Radio gives everybody the chance to go out there and just be what they want to be. 10 Radio is brilliant for that.
The best thing about 10 Radio is that it keeps the 10 parishes informed about all interested events taking place.
It's a privilege to broadcast to the community.
Everything's brilliant about 10 Radio. The best thing about 10 Radio is that it's just so easy to get involved.
10 Radio is great because it is one big roller coaster ride.
10 Radio is great because it brings a voice to the community.
The best thing about 10 Radio is it's a chance for everybody to get involved. Whoever they are, wherever they're from, just go for it.
And the best thing about 10 Radio is how it brings the whole community together and gets everyone talking, young and old, and all different races, really. It's just fantastic.
One of the presenters said to me, it was like a drug. I have to admit, I'm hooked, and so will you be.
10 Radio is really good, so you can say as many W's as you like. www.
10 Radio.
Little white ones, wuh, for white.
White, the white ones, okay, check.
Pheno barbitone, 5 milligrams.
Check.
Dissipel, 5 milligrams.
Check.
Glass of water.
Check.
Our Father, which art in heaven, mea culpa, mea culpa, mea maxima culpa.
Action. Let it all be a take. I'm trying every switch. So- So you want to be a fighter pilot?
A star fighter pilot, sir.
And why particularly a star fighter?
Because, sir, I am in love with this aircraft, this magnificent engine of steel and gleam.
Well, it's very poetic. Please continue.
This aerodynamic...
What are they talking about, Anton?
I'm not quite sure. I can't... don't remember this bit.
Perhaps they did this when you were sort of out of the studio. Covered,
whirling of dials...
Did the musicians used to come sort of like when you were locked up and the caretakers...
There was plenty of after-hours recording used to go on.
Was there?
Yeah.
Do you think they sort of like put this on the record behind your back?
They could have done it in the record company's office. For
they
all
could
I know.
Have, yeah. Yeah, well, just to add a
or
bit.
Just
of
to yeah, they did it to obviously enough.
But sir,
it's part of the concept of the album. I think that's what it is, isn't it? Yeah.
Well, about Starfighter. I mean, who would make a concept album about a starfighter?
Oh well, what was his name now, Rob? Robert Calvert.
Bob Calvert.
He was kind of at one stage the other half of Hawkwind.
Right, you know.
I mean, he wrote a lot of Hawkwind material, and was very, I think, you know, the great mates with Dave Brock, who was is and always has and still is, I guess, Hawkwind, the central core of Hawkwind.
But you can't quite remember this little
bit. I don't remember any of these bits, no. Mm-hmm. I mean, my involvement would have been musical recording.
Right,
you know, doing tracks and, you know, drums, bass, guitar, overdubs and stuff like that.
Well, so you probably did the ejection bits at the beginning.
Oh, certainly, I remember.
The heavy metal.
I remember that track, very much so, yeah.
Yeah, that was really good, wasn't it?
Yeah. It brought back some memories, I have to say. I've not heard it for years, that one.
Only a little bit.
Well, I think it's something I'd take down to my tomb.
Your mother?
Oh, well, fair enough, yeah. I mean, I knew it's a particular favourite of yours.
Well, that's right,
But, of course, actually, a lot of the records that we're going to play from tonight have different memories for me because of the involvement that I had with the band, being their engineer, and also, you know, where I was in my life at that time. Yeah, yeah, if you know what I mean. We needn't go too deeply into any of that.
Oh, what do you mean, too deeply? Oh, I think we're being overheard.
What? Well, who's listening?
Who is listening? Yeah.
Well, I can see the internet stats have shot up, haven't they? Or they just dropped. I'm not sure.
I think we've lost one and gained three, according to the computer screen.
Oh, well, I hope one of those isn't mine.
Yeah, well, Robert Calvert, I think, should we just sort of like consign him now totally to the tomb?
I think so.
I think I'll fade him down. I don't know what he was talking about then.
No, I missed it. No, because I was too busy on concentrating on what we were saying.
Welcome to Eddie's Egyptian Tomb. And this is the first time I've actually taken someone else to the tomb.
Oh, my goodness. Is that where I'm going?
Well, not only have I taken you there, I'm actually giving you the control. I'd like to welcome Anton Matthews.
And, I'm delighted to be here,
Now, Anton's sent me a little email, and I looked at this email, and I thought, blimey, he had something to do with most of the records that I was listening to in the mid-70s, and before. And I thought, well, what a coup for Eddie's Egyptian Tomb.
I've never been a coup before, Eddie.
But anyway, that's enough of... Captain Lockheed and the Starfighters and Robert Calvert, which Anton has got a credit on for technical assistance, I think. And I mean, can you actually remember what you did?
Not a huge amount, no. I mean, again, it's all a blur. It's quite a long time ago, but certainly some of the backing tracks I would have done. Certainly some of the overdub type things and the vocals. I think probably on that last track, the vocals, I seem to remember mixing it. I don't think so on that particular occasion. I mean, I would have done rough mixes at the end of the sessions. If I was that good, then I'm not sure. They may have used them, but there's lots of things that I was involved with, which I'm not sure whether or not they're what you hear now. But I was certainly there on one or two very memorable occasions. Yeah.
Now we're going to talk about some of the music that you had a professional involvement.
Indeed.
And,
But it sort of all started with you working in the BBC, didn't it?
That's right, Eddie. Yes, I was there for 6 months as a studio manager. Interesting enough, something that Jeremy Birchall, who has done all the jingles for 10 Radio, he, I think a few years later, was on the similar sort of course. Didn't stay with the BBC. Me and large organisations have never really got on that well, let's put it that way.
Were you...
having in fact left the BBC, I thought, well, I quite... you know, quite like this sort of recording lark. So I wrote to almost every recording studio I could find in Yellow Pages, etc. I wrote lots and lots of letters, got nowhere. And then one day I thought, well, I'll try a couple of phone calls. And the third phone call I made was to, and I lived in Barnes at the time, was to a studio, Olympic Sound in Barnes. The guy there said, Keith Grant, we'll pop in and we'll have a chat. So I popped in, had a chat with him, and he said, oh, well, we'll give you a try. I told him I'd learned how to cut tape at the BBC, splice tapes.
What, that's so, with a razor blade?
That's it, with a razor blade. Oh, serious razor. Oh, yeah, razor blade.
Half-inch tape?
That's it. Quarter stereo, right. The Beeb. It was all done on Studer's quarter stereo, quarter-inch tape. Anyway, so Keith Grant, I had a chat with him, and he said, well, we'll give you a try. I said, when do you want me to start? He said, now. And he took me into the recording studio with him and sat me in front of an 8-track machine. Now, I'd never seen an 8-track machine before. I mean, I just... one-inch tape.
So what would an 8-track be? Two 4-track recorders welded together?
Well, sort of. I mean, no, there was four lots of electronics on top and four lots underneath, and in the middle was something with the buttons, with a big one-inch wide tape. Oh, yeah. He said, you sit in front of that, and when I say, you press the buttons, the two buttons to record, and when I say, you press the other button to stop. But then 6 months later, I was behind the desk, because I just picked it up quickly, you know. I've always been into knobs and controls.
Yeah. Now, you've bought quite a few records with you. And I've bought a few as well. But I think the first one that we're going to play is by Slade. Now, this was very early Slade. In fact, that the album's called Play It Loud. Well, they look like skinheads, don't they?
This was the kind of album before they became famous, and they recorded it. They were with Chas Chandler, who then took them through the whole, you know, glam rock thing. And indeed, I worked again with them, mainly as tape operator, on a lot of those sort of hit records they made. Used to go and bang and clap in the corridors and all that. But yeah, this one was it's an interesting album. Some quite sweet little songs, I think, is the only way I can describe them. It says Play It Loud, because I think they wanted to, you know, they wanted to be loud, but the music in this wasn't loud. They hadn't developed that yet. So,
Of course, Chas Chandler was ex Animals.
He was
a chap who sort of discovered Jimi Hendrix as well, didn't he?
In London.
And he spoke to the current manager of the Animals at that time. The name is that Michael Jeffrey, I think. Michael Jeffrey was the manager. And there's a bit spooky because one of the owners of the White Hart is related to him.
Oh, really? Okay. Yeah. Well, it's a small world.
They all come to Withy.
They do. Yeah. Indeed.
And the Ten Parishes. But now, you've chosen a track called Pook Hill.
Yes, I mean, no particular reason except that I have a cousin who hopefully is listening in Norway at the moment, called, his nickname is Pook, Alexander. We in the family call him Pook, and I just thought it was nice to play this album for him if he's there.
And this is an album that you had something to do with?
Indeed, yes, I mixed it basically, which was my first mixing job, I guess, which is putting all the 8 tracks together and making it into a record.
Okay then, so we're going to play Pook Hill from Play It Loud, which was the first album by Slade.
Did you see us? Stood in a line. Did
That was Slade and Pook Hill. You chose that track because it had some interesting phasing on it. And as you said, it was sort of like a... I mean, not quite the Come Feel the Noise, really, that Slade became really, you know, in the glam rock days. It was a... Although it's Play It Loud, it's not really what I would call a very heavy rock album, is it?
No, as I said before, it was kind of slightly dinky tunes, and they hadn't really worked out the direction that they were going in as a band. But I did used to kind of, you know, sense and hear them talking about how they were going to progress. And of course I did see them, as I said again before, I said, you know, mentioned about how I was involved with them when they went the kind of big hand clapping, foot stamping, stomping noise, you know, come on, feel the noise type things. And at Olympic Sound Studios, there was a stairwell, all stone, that went up to the film projection suite at the top of the building. And we used to put microphones in the corridor there, and we get everybody in the studio to go out there to go, oi, 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 clap their hands, you know, that was with their later records.
That sounds a bit like Joe Meek. I heard that when he did his recording, he had someone in the bathroom, someone, you know, the drummer in the kitchen.
That's it, yeah. It's where there was a good acoustic. Yeah. And interesting, some of them, well, we'll come to the questions later from Dean, but kind of experimentation used to go on, and I don't think it does so much nowadays, because, you know, if you want a phasing sound, you plug it into one box and take it out the other end, you've got a phasing sound. But phasing in those days was a whole very complicated process, which in fact the guy that had recorded this Slade album, and indeed had done huge amounts with, you know, people like Led Zeppelin and so on and so forth, George Gyant, lovely guy, amazing technical brain, he showed us all how to do phasing. Yeah. It's a long story how you do that, so I won't go into it.
I think, was it the Small Faces on, was it Ichiku Park?
That was the first,
widest extent,
yeah,
really.
That was the first, that was the first sort of commercial time when it phasing, suddenly people went, phew, you know, what's that? How did they do that? It was an extraordinary noise, and indeed in those days quite a complicated technical thing to do. Perhaps I should write my thesis on it one of these days.
You mix?
Yeah, I was the mixing engineer.
So what stage of the record making process is the mixing then?
Basically, the bit where the recording is finished, they've, you know, used up all their studio time, used up all the money that's been supplied by the record company to make the album, and they're happy with, you know, pretty much with what they got on tape. They've done enough, you know, guitar solos and that sort of stuff to say, right, well, we need to mix the record. And again, I think, I can't remember exactly, but I think that Slade album was an 8-track album. In other words, it was on an 8-track recorder, so it would have been stereo pair for drums, a bass, two guitars, you know, rhythm guitar, lead guitar, and then vocals, and maybe a track for percussion, or if you had a bit of strings or something like that on it, then it was, sometimes you could double tracks. Again, used to get into some technical nightmares sometimes when you were trying to be too clever and put too much on, but it's amazing when you think, I mean, you know, some classic albums have been done on 4-track and with lots and lots of jumping and dubbing. So the mixing element, yes, comes when you've, everybody feels happy, we've got it on 8-track, we need to put it onto stereo tape so we can stick it onto vinyl, which is all you had in those days.
Right.
Stick it onto vinyl and get it pressed and, you know,
and
put it out.
And look what we got behind.
I know,
the
lovely.
We've got a couple of...
Those are the assets, are they, Eddie? Real silver discs.
We got two silver discs on our first week. No, they are actually stampers, press a vinyl.
Yeah.
I think they came from EMI Records.
So that's the kind of the negative, if you like.
That's right.
Yeah,
yeah,
of course, of the record.
Yeah.
I've never seen those before.
Yeah.
Used to go to lots of record pressings. No, those were the next process. Again, the process for vinyl records was extraordinarily complicated. You get it to tape, and then you take it to the cutting room, and there was a great bloke called Porky.
Porky, yeah, Porky Prime Cuts.
Lovely, lovely bloke, lovely chap.
Yeah, and he was quite particular what he mastered. Or that's the word, isn't it? Master,
yeah, that's it, yeah.
Any old thing.
No,
anything with Porky Prime cut on.
Yeah, Porky.
Had his, It's a marked distinction.
I've got a feeling he's still doing it, you know, probably in the States, but he was a lovely, lovely chap. Yeah. In effect, you transferred the tape onto a master record, and what used to happen, in fact, they'd cut one and then that would be an acetate, so you could listen to it and say, would you like the quality of that? I mean, that was a whole process, but then when you've decided on that, that then got made into one of these silver things that you've got behind us here, Eddie, and that was the one that went into the big machine that went and just slapped out, you know, however many copies they decided they were going to
I think we've got a white label in the corner. We were going to sort of play it and see what it was, because there's nothing written on it, but to see if it was, I don't know, That Will Be the Day by the Beatles, or Johnny Come Lately by whoever.
I've got some white labels, but they're all marked up what they are already, and they're usually pretty crummy acetates.
Okay, Okay then, now we're going to play a track from Brinsley Swart from the album Despite It All, which is written by Nick Lowe, who went on to produce The Damned and
all sorts of people.
Started in a group called Kippington Lodge, I believe, then joined Brinsley Swart. We're going to play a track called Country Home, I think.
Country Girl.
Oh, Country Girl.
Yeah, it was the hit single from the first album from the Brinsleys, as they were known. Fondly. I cut that off, Eddie, by pushing the microphone.
No, you didn't. No. You see, it's the old habits of a lifetime, isn't it?
It is a
bit. No, when you put the sliders up, Anton, that brings in the microphones. And when you bring them down all the way, then we hear the sound on the studio speakers.
Yeah, no, no, I understand that. Yeah, yeah. So I see what happened was it cut the studio speakers off, and I thought, oh, I've cut it.
We've just got a bit of a technical problem with Anton.
No, serious technical problem. He always has.
So that was Brinsley Swartz. Yeah. And, I mean, that wasn't actually from their first LP. First LP is a beautiful album. It's got a picture of an Indian on the front, and I always thought it was signed by Brinsley Swartz, but I looked at it and it's just ink. But they had a lot of hype when they came out, didn't they?
That's right. I mean, this particular album, to launch it, they had a whole big hype thing of taking, you know, all of the then press, people from Melody Maker and New Musical Express and all sorts of papers like that, were taken in a plane to New York. I don't know exactly what went wrong, because I wasn't that involved with it. I didn't get asked, of course.
No.
It was years until I went to the States, but that's another story. Yeah, so the Brinsleys, I did do a couple of other albums, I think. Certainly one I'm aware of, Silver Pistol, which we'll come to later.
That's right, They were a lovely group. I mean, I saw them several times playing live on the pub circuit.
Yes, I'm trying to think of the place. There was a super pub up in North London they used to play a lot at. Yeah, went to see them
Hope
a couple of times. And the whole sort of stable out of United Artists used to play there a lot, and all of the, you know, people like the Ian Drury and people like that used to play there.
Yeah, of course, United Artists, the A&R man was a chap called Andrew Lauder. I think British music really owes a real debt to Andrew Lauder.
Absolutely. And he's still around. Yeah.
Yes, and he actually lives in the West Country.
He lives at
South Moulton's. Yes, he runs a very good reissue label called Evangeline Rec. He champions so many people. Particularly, you know, in the West Coast, and he started Silvertone Records as well with Stone Roses. You know, what a great guy.
Mm.
And I get Record Collector magazine, and a couple of years ago he did a little article, and I was quite pleased that he mentioned two of the groups I really like a lot, which is one was Blossom Toes, and I think the other one was Pato.
I didn't come across either of those ones.
They probably went to other studios.
Could well have done, yeah.
So why would someone go to Olympic Studios? Because that's, you know, as opposed to some of the other ones around.
Well, good question. I think one of the things about Olympic Sound was it was like going to the country, but it wasn't the country. And of course, in those days, there were country recording studios. The central London studios were the big ones, although there was one out in Wembley, but that was kind of fairly industrial area. But Barnes is a lovely place. I mean, you know, you walk out the studio 100 yards down the road, you're on Barnes Common, and it's lovely.
Yeah, and
very
lovely
peaceful
pubs there,
very nice pubs.
Pubs,
that's right, yeah, and easy to get to, I think, as well. And it's not central London, which as always is quite a sweat to get in and out of, especially equipment for the band and all that kind of stuff. And also I think it was reasonably priced. Part of Olympic Sound was there was a huge amount of kind of freedom, if you like, and that was down to the management. Ran it, who I spoke of previously, Keith Grant, still is a wonderful guy. I mean, he's done so much stuff, all the kind of, you know, London Symphony Orchestra rock concert things, he does all that, amazing guy.
Because Anton's, he's got a record, but it's a Japanese pop star, wasn't it?
This was one of those ones where you suddenly get given a job and you don't realise what's involved. It was, okay, Anton, you're on this session, which he's famous in Japan, you know, he's number three in the pop charts and all this, that, and he's sold billions of records. He's come to London and it's a concept album. He's a sailor, he comes to London, falls in love, rhubarb, rhubarb. It's all sung in Japanese, so I don't know what it was about, but there's a sweet track on it called We Are the Sailors, spelled S-I-A-L-E-R-S, so something got lost in the translation there. This was an interesting album. It was done in 3 days.
That fast going in those days.
Oh, gosh, yes, I think it was in those days.
Well, I think Led Zeppelin 1, which probably is a classic record, that was done in a couple of days.
Well, it could have been, yeah. I mean, certainly to have a full orchestra and everything like that was probably pretty unique. So, yeah, I was involved in recording the backing track, if you like, drums, bass and guitars, adding the orchestra, adding the harmonies, and I think they had, you know, some quite well-named singers on singing background vocals on this particular album, and then mixing it. again, Japanese tradition, they were awfully kind and gave me it, and I've still got it, and it still works, a Sony FM stereo tuner, to say thank you for having done a good job on the album, and we'll listen to one of the tracks, we'll see whether it was any good or not.
Yeah. I mean, it's a very lavishly produced record, and even if you were blind, you would be able to feel, because it's like got an embossed sleeve. It's called Julie
in London, Julie, and it's a fella, right, who was ever so nice, didn't speak a word of English, but there's lots of bowing, scraping, smiling nicely at everybody, and the manager chap was very nice, he did speak a bit of English.
Okay, so, and we're the Sailors. Sailors, quite delightful actually. I mean, there was a
that lovely drum break in the middle, I think was Clem Cattini from memory, who was again probably been on more records than anyone ever realizes. He was on so many, and there was another guy called Bobby Orr who was a Scottish chap, great drummer as well, and it was their bread and butter, it was they paid their rent.
Yeah, paid their rent,
absolutely. Yeah. And other people like sort of Herbie Flowers and so on, he may have played bass on that, I don't think it's mentioned. Most of the album of course is written in Japanese because it was recorded for the Japanese market, and they put this little bit in about it being in London, and then there's a picture of Windsor Castle.
And there's actually a picture of Anton.
Oh, my goodness.
And he's wearing dark glasses.
I can't remember why I probably wore the dark glasses because the camera lights were so strong. But in that picture to the left, there's a little chap there. He was only 18 or something, but his dad was Hurricane Smith, who went on, he did a hit single, didn't he,
Hurricane Smith is probably famous from my point of view because he produced most of the early Pink Floyd.
Oh, that's right. And in fact, he was also the sound engineer for early Beatles records as well. Hurricane Smith. He worked at Decca Studios and did a lot of the first sort of Beatles hit songs, Can't Buy Me Love and tracks and so on. Yeah, so that's interesting. But it's a very 70s it was, wasn't it? So there's pictures of Carnaby Street and so on.
Yes, yeah. I think the name of that shop is Lord Kitchener's something.
Was it
or other?
Lord Kitchener's Valet, yeah. Was it called, or something like that?
That's 65 Kings Road.
And that's right. It's probably near to Granny Takes a Trip, which was another well-known clothing emporium for buying with it clothes.
But there's a wonderful picture of the actual Olympic Studios with mm-hmm. with all the sound. They don't have egg boxes, but I can see
they do though. They're quite yeah. quite a good effective, quite an effective way of actually deadening the sound of yeah. a room. But
and of course there is a string quartet and mm-hmm. and I actually noticed some lovely oboe on that mm-hmm. and
well they were probably set behind the screens. You used to have these sound screens and again if you had a session with strings, the drummer was in a separate little booth which was made up, had a roof on top, but he had then windows so he could see everybody and the conductor, and he'd bash away, but you still used to get the sound of the drum spilling over onto the strings, and that was part of the that actually created part of the sound of the studio.
That was one of our questions actually from Dean, and one of his questions was with all the big studios in the 60s, for example Abbey Road in London and Muscle Shoals in America, and there are others like Electric Ladyland and what made Olympic special?
It's a very, very good question that Dean's put. He's summarised it by saying, why were individual studios so different back then? I sort of blame it, I think, in a way, on technology. I mean, the thing is now, you can create everything to perfection. You can get a perfect room, you can get perfect sound out of the speakers, you can measure it all perfectly, it's all recorded digitally, it's all perfect. But there were some nice imperfections at those times, and every studio was built slightly differently. Also, I guess, you know, the engineers would have different ideas on how to set things, how to place microphones, as I mentioned before, how to take advantage of something that existed, not necessarily yeah. uniquely, but something which was, you know, quite a clever idea, to stick some microphones up the stone stairwell yeah. and bang and clap, because it had a lovely reverb to it, which, you know, was the kind of thing you might get in the back of some theatre if the lads were all stomping and thumping. It was, you know, that kind of going back to the Slade kind of come on feel the noise type of touch. And also, of course, the equipment, I think, was equipment is different these days, but everything again is made to perfection. If you buy a sound desk nowadays, I'm sure it's probably got wonderfully flat EQ all the way from 0 up to 100 kilohertz without getting too technical.
Yeah, it's getting
you know
technical
what I mean?
Now.
No. Yeah. But the point is, of course, I think in those days, you know, desks were different. You know, some were higher quality than others. And again, also at that time, of course, there was a transition, from valves to transistors to integrated circuits and so on. I mean, certainly I can remember some of the stereo machines that we used to record onto were Ampeg, and they were valved. I'm not technical enough to go into a whole great diatribe and discussion about why that's an advantage, but I think people who have tried and different and who are into hi-fi and stuff will say, well, yeah, valves had a much warmer sound. George Gansel was used to say to me, well, of course, valves and analog, if you like, captures the transients. In other words, you can't relate the dynamic of a sound that is unique. You can't change that into a digital sound and then put it back into it doesn't work.
No.
That was his argument, and I kind of see what he's getting at. If you suddenly break everything down to noughts and ones, which is what you do with digital, and then convert it back, it's going to have that kind of perhaps slightly clinical feel to it.
Yeah,
some people like that, but I still love listening to my old valve amp, an old quad valve amp with Wharfdale speakers.
Yeah,
it's a warm sound.
Yeah.
It doesn't go zing and have super boomy bass or tss on the top, but it's a warm sound and it's just nice for playing.
Well, that's right. I mean, I've got Spendall speakers, for example, which are they're BBC reference type speakers. And I've got quad as well, funny enough. This is all spooky, isn't it?
Yeah.
But that equipment is still going strong now.
And worth a fortune. I mean, you know, it costs a bomb to buy a quad amp on eBay or something like that. Shouldn't be advertising, should we?
Yeah. When you'd mix the final track or the album, then I suppose you'd have a listening, would you? Everyone would, you know, all the musicians would come in.
Oh, yeah.
And did you listen to the sound? Because probably by then you'd probably heard it so many times.
This is the difficult thing. That's right. The difficult thing as the recording engineer was actually being objective about what you'd done and making any kind of... You couldn't really make any judgment on it. It wasn't up to you to make that judgment. You'd played your part in it and in some cases sort of been involved, and this is what, you know, developed for me, into being more involved with the music of the band. I mean, that's what when you start getting into production of records. So, but yes, once the album was mixed and everybody was happy with it, the producer included, then he would, you know, take it away, play it to the record company people. They might say yes, they're happy with it. They would then make the decisions on perhaps what tracks off the album are going to be singles
and the track order and all that sort of stuff.
Now, we've waffled on there quite a bit, haven't we? And haven't set something else up, but maybe we could go... do you want to move on? It's a bit of chronological order here, because we talked about Brinsley Schwarz, but the Silver Pistol album, now that was an interesting one. There were a couple of other engineers who were involved in it, but that was... and indeed, I think some of the band themselves, particularly Ian Gom, who's a brilliant guitarist, awfully nice chap, he was also into doing sound recording and stuff, and so what happened there was that they lived in this big house in Northwood, in North London. And
I used to play football in Northwood.
Did you? Well, there we are.
At that time, yeah.
Oh, okay.
So if anyone in Harrow is listening,
yes,
we used to play up in Northwood, yeah.
They got a little studio set up in the living room, another room in the house. They went and did the recording. So, and then in fact one track on this album was recorded out in the garden, and a Labrador dog ran across the stereo microphones, and we loved it so much they said, oh, we'll keep that, that's the master take. But there's a very pertinent to the title of your show.
Now, what would that be?
The track is called Egypt. So, I mean, you know, here we are. We're all off to Egypt to be put in this tomb and be taken to goodness knows where. But so perhaps Egypt is the appropriate track from the album Silver Pistol by Brinsley Schwarz.
Okay.
That's the track with the dog, you see.
Yeah, I heard it. Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. Oh. That's opportune. I think we'll have to fade it out, Eddie. Go on, off you go.
It's all right.
He's on the controls.
Right, yeah. So, I mean, you said immediately that came on.
It was a kind of an open air sound of the vocals, and it was that. I mean, it was early one morning, and everything, for some reason, we'd taken all the drums and everything. They just wanted an outdoor atmosphere, and because it was Northwood, I think airplanes used to fly over, so I think we just thought,
taking quite a risk, weren't they?
Early morning, good time. Well, then the risk was, of course, the dog, and they loved it so much. Never mind, I must have played that track more than once because it's clicking away after that. So I've obviously showed it to people, but I'd forgotten it was that track. So how opportune, yeah. Same sort of stable, Eddie, as the Brinses, and very much linked with, of course, a guy called Dave Robinson, who, as you said, I think already mentioned him, went on to start Stiff Records and then went to huge great things. And he'd been started off as a roadie for Jimi Hendrix, Dave Robinson.
All right, alongside Lemmy, I think.
Quite possibly.
I think he had something to do with Jimi Hendrix.
Interesting. Well, a lot of people did in a lot of different ways. That's another story.
We might come to that a bit later.
So yeah, but linked with them then was a band called Help Yourself, which I did do a lot with. Their first album was produced by Dave Robinson, and then they sort of went on to, I think Dave Robinson was off doing his own thing, so they went off and started doing other things. And I don't know if there's any tracks you want to play for. I mean, we've got three of the Help Yourself albums here.
Help Yourself are a group that, well, I mean, I've got all their albums, and I actually saw them play at the Roundhouse as well. They were very much influenced by the West Coast of America, and they were a Welsh band as well. So they were alongside the Man Band, which I think we'll be talking about the Man Band, because you did a lot of work for the Man Band, didn't you?
One of my sort of first sort of full record production things was the Man Band. Well, why don't we play the title track from the second, is it the second album? No, the third album, actually, called Strange Affair. From memory, this was recorded down in a place called Headley Grange. Lovely big country house. It was interesting doing kind of this outside recording. They had some recording equipment down there, and some of the recording was done at Headley Grange. And a lot of other things were done at Headley Grange, which I don't think we ought to go into at the moment. It is a whole different culture, which we perhaps ought not to.
Well, the sort of thing that makes people forget things.
I often wonder
odd things,
why.
Yes,
but perhaps it's.
I did meet Nick Lowe once when I was with my friend Andy, and I think we were in a pub together. And but after about 10 minutes, he did ask me what my name was again, and he was very nice about it. That in 10 minutes he'd forgotten my name, but many people forget my name anyway. But I think he'd had a very interesting time with Brinsley Swartz, and he learned a few things when he went out to America as well.
And of course went on to produce Elvis Costello and that whole stable, didn't he? Yes.
We're going to play Strange Affair from Help Yourself.
And you've been brooding on a
that was Help Yourself and the title track from their third album, which was called Strange Affair. Now here, Anton, you've moved up in the world, haven't you?
Well, I guess so, yeah.
You're no longer a recording engineer, you are the producer.
Well along with the band, that's right. I mean, you become, and I think this happens to most producers, doesn't it? They become a member of the band. I mean, you know, even bands like the Beatles had George Martin, who without his influence and his masterfulness wouldn't have ever made some of the amazing sounds that they did. He just had that sort of magic touch. And I like to think on this album that I had a little bit of that, because there's in that particular one there's some guitars that happen, and suddenly there's a sort of double treble or trebling of the guitar sound.
Yeah, I mean for those
lead licks.
For those that don't know Help Yourself, they a group with twin guitars. I mean, another group in those days, I think Wishbone Ash used double guitars.
Oh yes, they used to record at Olympic, Wishbone Ash, with a colleague of mine,
Well, just off air we were talking about, right, well obviously most groups have got like a natural leader. I mean, it could be the person who's written the song, perhaps, and he's got a feel in his mind. And then you've got the producer. So what role does the producer play in creativity?
I think in my case was really having these musical guys putting all this stuff together and being given that wonderful opportunity to add some effects, to make it sound nice, to, you know, just to giving it a little bit of spit and polish, adding something else to it, but with the, you know, with the acceptance of the band, you know, and they would include you, as you know, they would look to you to say, well, you know, what can we do to make this that little bit, have that little bit of extra something about it. And
and I suppose you also, you know, to some extent, look, you know, keeping hold of the purse strings, I suppose, making sure that they
weren't
overdoing their time in the studio.
Well, one had to be conscious of that. I don't ever recall. No, I never. I mean, I've never been brilliant on budgets and stuff like that. My wife would tell you that. She does all of that. Bless her. Yeah. But I wasn't conscious of that. Although I had to be conscious, yes, of, you know, we've only got so much studio time.
What is studio time, then? I mean, this was probably in the union days.
Well, with a with a band, I think that they, you know, the record company would say, well, look, you've got X amount of money to go and record an album, and I mean, and out of that,
and in those days, what would it cost a day?
A studio. It's you know, what would seem like loose change these days, an hour to have to go into a recording studio. I honestly can't remember. I can't remember. 30, 40 pounds an hour, something like that. Not very much. You know, you think, crikey. Yeah. You know, for the whole of the facility, for all that expensive equipment to be able to use it, and all the staff at the place and so on. But I can admit this nowadays, can't I? I mean, with things like the Man Band, and don't think I got an advance royalty on this one. I was never very clever at some signing on the dotted line. But with Andrew Lord,
we're actually going to have to pay Anton some royalties now from playing some of this stuff.
Ever hopeful.
But the producer's role is to at the end of the day get a finished product, presumably, which the band is happy with.
Which the band is happy with, and which the guy back at the record company, and you mentioned Andrew Lord, who's I would go he was God, because you had to go with him with a finished product, and he would decide whether or not it was marketable, and usually he was, you know, again, he was tremendous in that respect, because he respected what the band had produced as a band, you know, as a band. And I think he was clever anyway, had already realizing he was onto something.
He had that excellent ear for
music. Absolutely,
I seem to remember he liked a group called the Del Vikings. I may be wrong, but that was one of his favourite bands. But he had this sort of knowledge that went back, back in the 60s, 50s, whatever.
So he was kind of God, in as much as he was the guy that the record company you took it to, and obviously he and his team would then sort out and say whether it's acceptable or not, and then how to progress with it. And also then, of course, he was God, in as much from my point of view, he was then the guy that was going to give you a next job. And now it's later on in the story, really, but when I went off with the band touring and stuff and came back, he'd left United Artists And yeah. So my source of work had dried up. So going back into the studio was very hard for me.
Yeah, and I know where he went. He went to Stiff Records, and then with Jake Jakeman set up Demon Records and Edsel Records, and that's where.
Yeah.
I mean, I did meet him when he was at United Artists, because my best friend at that time was Andy Childs, and he was seemed to latch on to United Artists, did a lot of press for that, and you know, luckily Andy took me to quite a few gigs, and they were mostly United Artists bands, and it was they were really. Halcyon days, I would say.
In many ways, yes, yeah. So, yes, that was Hope. So, there was another United Artists band who've gone on and to other things and done different things, and I think are probably incredibly well known, is Hawkwind. I guess it's a very odd way they've put my the sort of credit, if you like, on this album, because they talk in extraordinary kind of spacey language and then say something at the end along the lines of. And thank you to Anton at Olympic. I don't know quite what was that was all right. about, except that I played some part in being involved in some of the recording of this. And now I don't know.
Now
this is very scratched, and I think might not be worth playing anything from that particular album. But Do Re Mi Fa Sol La Ti Do, for those musical people out there, you'll know that that's the scale of the thing. And I think. The way I saw it was that Hawkwind had only just discovered that and thought they'd discovered, you know, something original.
They probably found the secret of the universe.
Absolutely, yeah, I think so. Yeah, there was this magic. I mean, I knew that from choir boy days, but there was this magic sort of language, if you like, and they based this whole thing around it. I mean, a couple of guys in the band, although they played Moogs, they weren't musical at all. They just had fun.
They probably knew how to plug it in.
That's it. No, they knew that. Yeah, and they were just having fun, making funny noises, really.
Yeah, we'll be talking about a Moog synthesizer, hopefully a little bit later on.
Oh, yeah.
One that Pete Townsend showed you once.
Indeed, yes.
Some people, you know, come up and see me and... I'll show you my pictures with Pete Townsend. It was come up and I'll show you my Moog synthesizer bit for Barbara O'Reilly, wasn't
it? That's right. Yeah,
but what track are we playing on this one, this Hawkwind?
Well, I'm worried, Eddie, that it's terribly scratched, and all the tracks are terribly long. But I'll just stick it on and fade it in, and let's see what comes out of it.
Right. So it's
I should just stick the needle on with the fader turned down, and then we'll wick it up and see what happens, we'll give that a miss.
So this is a bit of a blind,
bit of a random one. Do we just knock the fader down on that? There we go.
Okay, I'll start it anywhere on it.
Start it anywhere on it, and we'll see what it sounds like.
There's about two sides of that, isn't there?
Yeah, just song.
Yeah, that was just one song. Yeah.
Well,
it sounded a bit like Silver Machine.
Well, of course, yeah, that was their, that had been their big hit. I want a silver machine, and they'd managed to keep that down to kind of 3.5 minutes, which made it a good single, and big it was. I mean, worldwide hit, you know, this kind of whole space-agey thing. But Hawkwind was all about that. It was kind of searching, exploring territories, you know, unknown, previously unexplored territories.
Mainly through
substances that we shouldn't discuss at this stage.
They didn't actually make the covers very easy to read. It's sort of like black on silver writing, which was probably, I suppose it must have come similar to Oz magazine. I mean, a lot of Oz magazine
used to do those.
You just couldn't read it.
No, that's kind of,
But they're worth a lot of money now.
Oh,
and there's Captain Calvert.
Yeah, he's on there.
And his strapping cohort, Stacia.
Well, as you mentioned, she used to. This is true. Well, she used to do the extraordinary, extraordinary dancing on stage at their gigs, didn't she? Taking off various bits of clothing.
Until she had nothing left take off. Really.
Or nothing left not to show, or whatever.
And of course, was Lemmy on this then?
Yes, he was in the band at that time, yes, Lemmy, and of course went on to Motorhead fame.
Bumped
into him a few years back. It turned out he lived opposite my mum in Kilburn.
And funny enough, I worked as a job centre manager in Kensington, and my deputy, he was in a punk rock band called Johnny Moped, and I always asked him, well, what was your name, John? And he said, well, I'm not telling you. Try and work it out. And I think he was actually Johnny Moped. So he went on tour with Lemmy, and he had some very interesting story about how Lemmy had offered him, some medicinal tablets or something. And he said they were wholly organic, and they wouldn't do him any harm at all. And he said, no, I only drink real ale, Lemmy. And he said, no. And he, you know, showed him this sort of plastic bag. And anyway, I mean, how can you turn Lemmy down, particularly when he's not buying the next round? And he said to me, you know, Eddie, I took a couple of tablets and I woke up 2 days later and I was on Victoria Station. I can't remember what I'd done in the last couple of days.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
So there's probably quite a lot of that happening.
There's plenty of that happening, and it's amazing how some of the people survived through all of that. You know, there's some classic examples, and I guess Lemmy's one of them. Bless him, he's an amazing player.
Well,
I heard you play one of his, was it Ace of Spades? Well, that was his big single, wasn't it? That was on the show. 30 plus years
that's
on.
Right.
Yeah,
and I did actually go to a concert, and it was the Blue Oyster Cult at the Hammersmith Odeon, and it was, I think it was the first time they came over, and Motorhead were the support band, and I didn't actually go in because they were playing so loud.
Spooky. Very spooky, because I was at that gig too, Eddie. I remember that gig, and Blue Oyster Cult were advertised as being the loudest band in the world, and they were loud. I mean, seriously loud. They had like something like 5,000 watts per speaker. Yeah. I mean, it was ridiculous.
Yeah.
And I remember that gig. Yeah.
And actually,
I was used to loud noise. I mean, you know. So.
Well, I stayed in the bar actually, and there was a guy called Peter Purvis who was well into. He was into heavy metal, and probably still is.
Yeah.
From Blue Peter fame, and he came out and he said that's just too loud for me. And that was Motorhead, and I think they just really just started.
They were trying to compete with Blue Oyster Cult. Yeah. As I say, they were being hailed as being the loudest band in the world from America. I think, and Lemmy, typical Lemmy, would have said, "Oh, so we're going to do the same. We'll be louder than them." Excuse my language.
And they are still going. How many years? I can't add it up. But 30 years.
30
later.
Plus years later. Yeah.
That is just amazing. Yeah. And Lemmy is just loved by everyone.
Oh, he is.
He's almost
great
like an Ozzy Osbourne type.
Perhaps more together definitely. In many ways. Nice guy.
Yeah. Well, what are we going to play next then?
Well, oh goodness gracious, now you've got me on
Ellis.
The
phone, Ellis.
Oh.
Now that is a group I did see as well.
Well, you see, you've got the better of me there, Eddie, because you saw many of these bands, and I didn't. I only saw them when I didn't go to that many gigs, funny enough, and because I was sort of worked within the studios with them, and I was carry on making the bread and butter, really, working in the studios when they were all off gigging until a bit later on in my short career. as it were. And Steve Ellis had been, was it Love Cult?
The Love Affair.
Love Affair.
Yeah, Everlasting
Love. Thank
you, JJ.
Thank you. That's, he's absolutely our background prompter there, JJ, helping us along. Yeah. That's right.
Yeah.
Everlasting Love. That's it. Well, anyway, he set a band called Ellis. Again, wonderful musicians, amazing guys who've all had good track records, including George Zoot Money, who's I still bumped into occasionally and still going strong.
The first track of the album, Ellis, Riding on the Crest of a Slump.
That's it. That was the title of the album. Yeah.
Was a young man playing his guitar out in the rain. Well, he sang this song and he sang it just for me. And I could tell he didn't have any shoes on his feet. Don't it make you feel good to be alive? I went down the road a little bit further on. There was a lady standing bursting into song. Well, she sang so sweet, she made me cry. Shook my hand and then she said, don't it make you feel good to be alive? Don't it make you feel good to be alive? With the sun pouring down, no more 9 to 5. Well, you pay your money, go and see your friends. You got a whole lot of time and it's a long week. Get down to the country just as fast as I can. Find my mind where I left it in a milky pan. I talk to the trees and the horses too. They understand what I mean. You could too. Don't it make you feel good to be alive? A red sky of night, they say, is the shepherd's delight. Some things you see turn out alright. There are some things you touch, some things you feel, some things that you live through that are so unreal. Don't it make you feel good to be alive? Good to be alive when the sun's pouring down and no more 9 to 5. When you pay your money, go and see your friends. You got a whole lot of time and it's a long weekend. Don't it make you feel good to be alive? Don't it make you feel good to be alive when the sun's pouring down? No more 9 to 5. When you pay your money, go and see your friend. You got a whole lot of time and it's a long weekend. Don't it make you feel good to be alive and alive and glad to be? Don't it make you feel good to be alive and alive and glad to be? Don't it make you feel good to be alive and alive and glad to be?
Well, that was they were really enjoying themselves doing that.
Happy track, and a happy album that, and I think a lot of that was instilled by the producer of that album, which was Roger Daltrey from The Who. All around about that, I was involved with The Who in so many different ways. I went down to Roger Daltrey's house and recorded some Leo Sayer stuff. His kind of demos they were for his first album.
Yeah, well, actually, that did sound a bit like Leo Sayer.
It's the kind of feel good factor, and that was, you know, it was great. It was a fun album to do, and again, some terrific names on there. Maggie Bell, some fantastic voice, and Mick Weaver, amazing keyboard player, and Gary Farr on harmonica. He was on that track. He wasn't on every track on this album, but of course, as you mentioned,
Because Gary Farr used the group Mighty Baby, which is actually the group we've given the name of this, well, so-called radio program, Egyptian Tomb. And it was the Mighty Baby band that played, you know, on a lot of different sessions for various people. And they were also in the pub, you know, they became Chili Willy and Red Hot Peppers and that sort of thing. And, yeah. But say, you know, Roger Daltrey, The Who, well, I mean, they were probably one of the biggest bands in the UK at that time, if not the world. So was that your first association with The Who then?
Well, yeah, it's interesting enough. I'd sort of forgotten, to some extent, forgotten about that. I guess it must have been, and because it wasn't until sort of later on that I got, you know, quite a bit more involved with The Who, which
we may have jobs, didn't you? You jumped studio.
Well, sort of, yes. What happened was that when I'd been for 5 years or so at Olympic Sound, I was a tape operator mainly, but I mean by that time I was doing a lot of engineering, so I would have been doing some overdubbing and stuff on The Who's next album, which was again amazing album. It's a classic, has to be, even though I was there. But that was an eye opener, and they, I think, well, they must have liked me because they said, well, look, we're opening a quadraphonic studio, and nobody had ever done that before in Battersea, and I happened to live in Battersea, so it was easier to get up in the mornings and dig myself out of bed to get to work, but we'd like to be the studio manager for our new quadraphonic studio. Well, of course, the studio was still being set up basically, and they wanted me there as a technical bod to kind of make sure the speakers were in phase and all that sort of stuff, and everything worked. But whilst I was there, I was sort of just playing about with a new desk and stuff, and recording some of the backing tracks for Quadrophenia, which was also being recorded outside in a big American caravan thing, which was a sound studio basically. With, I think most of that album actually came from that outside recording, if you like. But they used the studio itself at Ramport in Battersea, still going, I believe, owned by somebody else, not owned by The Who.
And it was in Battersea because basically that's where Pete Townsend lived, was there?
No, not at all. No, I don't know why they'd pick Battersea, but it was there. Well, once they were doing that Keith Moon decided he didn't like the look of me sitting behind the desk. So fortunately there was a big sort of double plated glass between me and him, but he slung a cymbal at me symbolically.
Why did he sort of take this sudden dislike then?
I don't know, it wasn't a dislike, he didn't dislike, because again I went on and he was the boss, if you like, when I worked with the Steve Gibbons band, but which we may have time for later on. But no, he was just like that. He was an extrovert, you know. I did see him do some crazy things, but he was also a very, very sweet and nice man when he was sober.
Yeah. Well, that's right. Yeah, yes, I mean, I heard, I've heard a few Who stories, and the one I always like is now Pete Townsend generally worked all that, you know, his songs obviously. Mm. He worked them out, and he would record them at home on his own little, you know, equipment whatever. Yeah. You know, he'd play all the instruments, and he'd produce a demo for the group.
Yeah.
And he gave one of these demos, and I think it may well have been, I don't know, Who's Next or whatever, or, you know, to each of the group members. And I think Keith Moon was in a hotel or something in the States, and he was listening to probably on an 8-track or something like that, or a little cassette, you know, mini Walkman or whatever, and he had it on too loud, and he's probably disturbing quite a few people around him. And then the hotel manager came up and said, can you please switch off that noise? And I think Keith Moon looked up at him, and he said, can you come with me? I can't do a Keith Moon. Oh, can you do a Keith Moon?
Oh, not really. He spoke a bit gruffly like
that. He did it. Oh, right. Oh, I can probably do a bit like that. No. You come up with me, young man, or whatever.
And yes, he called everybody young man.
Young man, yeah. And he took this hotel manager or concierge or whatever up to a room, and he did his proverbial smashing the room up, and you know making a lot of noise while he was doing it, and then did his normal throwing things out the window or whatever, and he then turned around to the guy and said, now young man, that was noise. This is the oo.
Well, that's an interesting one, because there's another side to that as well. In fact, Glyn Johns, who recorded and produced Who's next album and did some subsequent stuff with them as well, I think he's worked quite closely with them over the years, I remember him saying, listening to a demo that Pete played in the studio, this is when they were doing the Who's next album, and he turned, my recollection of it is that he turned aside to me, he said, I don't know how I can better the recording of that, you know, it's just amazing, because he's brilliant, you know. Pete was very, very much into doing the demos, and he produced amazing demos, and which made it terribly easy, because then for the band, in many respects, not all they had to do, but they put their own unique magic to it, and that was part of the whole formula, which was what was so exciting. Yeah,
and part of that making that album was Pete Townsend introducing
and his Moog machine. I distinct recollection again at Olympic Sound where dear Anna Menzies, she was in charge of the studio. She used to give us all the jobs, and she used to know who would be right for who in terms of working with different bands, and so she'd put me to work as tape op on this album. I did do a lot of it, but then so did other people, and people like who are still in the business, a guy called Smudger and Phil Chapman, John Astley, people like that, who are still in the business doing wonderful things, and all went on to other things, stayed in the business basically, which arguably perhaps I should have done, I don't know. That's another story. I was setting up the studio, the microphone on the drums and all this, that and the other, and he said, oh, come here, Anton, and he had this amazing Moog which like stretched for miles. He said, oh, it cost me $4,000. I mean, in those days it was a lot of money, but
yeah, we're talking about 1971,
my goodness. Yeah, that's right, because I was still sort of tape hopping really and doing a little bit of overdubbing and stuff, but anyway, he was obviously very proud to show me this amazing new instrument of his, and he said, here, listen to this, and he pressed the button and the backing track came on, which is Barbara O'Reilly, which is just amazing. I mean, it's just incredible. And of course that was what then they had to work to, strict regime in many respects, because of course on stage they had to work to that as well. So if, you know, if they were feeling they wanted to get a bit of speed up and they were getting along with it, well, they couldn't, because they were restrained by the backing track on that. Won't Get Fooled Again, that's the same situation, that it was based on this amazing Moog synthesis that Pete had put together. Yeah. And Won't Get Fooled Again is my favourite track of all time, but I don't know, are you going to pick a track from this then?
We've been talking about this Moog synthesizer, and I'm looking at a reissued CD, remastered.
Well, Barbara O'Reilly's a good one. I'd probably sound better than I did.
Well, that's right. And I'm reading what it says. Barbara O'Reilly, Dave Arbus plays violin, reduced from a 9-minute ARP synthesizer demo by Pete.
That's it.
Which the band then reconstructed. Yeah. This was recorded at Olympic in May 1971. Ooh. Not played on stage by The Who until much later in the year, when it became a live favourite.
Yeah. Well, and Keith Moon actually produced the violin bit at the end of this. He was the producer.
Right, so we're going to play Barbara O'Reilly, which I think most people have heard, but
it's always worth a second listen.
And Anton, you heard the synthesizer bit well before it even got into the recording studio.
Yeah, that's right. Thank you.
I mean, just see Anton's face when everything's... And it just sort of... Well, I think it took a few years off you as well.
Yeah, I guess so.
It must have been great listening to that, the first mix of it and all that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But we've only got about another 20 minutes and there's several other bands that we want to mention. I think the first one is The Man Band, yes?
Yeah. I mean, this is my first sort of full production, you know, when I actually got paid to be the producer. It was an album called Slow Motion. And there was an interesting story about this because the picture on it is actually was originally a picture of the guy from
it's a Rick Griffin cover actually.
Yeah, what was this? The face I can't remember. Anyway, there was a whole thing about using the image of to do with the copyright on the picture. So in fact, what they finished up doing was use a quarter of the picture, which is a sort of strange picture of a fish being held. And it was called Slow Motion. That was the title of the album.
Yeah, but the actual, most of the graphics and everything on the album was by Rick Griffin. Well, he did a lot of the Grateful Dead album covers, and he's probably seen as the archetypal rock poster, West Coast of America posters are just stunning. And and they go for thousands and thousands of dollars now. And the Man Band used his graphics. He probably commissioned him to do the graphics for the Man Band. And from Wales, Deke Leonard was their lead guitarist. And actually, Ken Whaley, he seems to have jumped help yourself and joined the Man Band. But also they had another guitarist, again, Mickey Jones, and Terry Williams on drums.
Well, Terry Williams is he's a well-known drummer on the circuit now. He's played with everybody. Brilliant drummer. I mean, he's just such a good timekeeper and such an amazing fill. Yeah, drum fills are unbelievable. Super nice guy as well. Eddie, I'm going to ask you to play from this a track called Rock and Roll You Out, which has on it my brother James playing harmonica, and he still does that in bar.
Here we go.
Here we go. Excellent. Rock and Roll You Out. Another feel-good track, that one, Eddie, isn't it? Yeah. I mean, they just, they had that magic.
That's right, yeah, and they could, well, they'd play all night.
Yeah,
they?
Oh, know, absolutely.
And longer if they could have had, yeah, you know, the opportunity.
They'd probably hold the record, yeah.
Yeah, and of course they played with John Cipollina. They mm-hmm. brought John Cipollina over to play at the Roundhouse, which I went to, yeah, that gig, you know, and... Yeah. And they recorded it with Vic Mail.
Vic Mail, yes, yeah, Vic Mail.
It is an outside, yeah, forecast type thing.
That's right, yeah. I did Vic Mail and I did quite a bit of Hawkwind together, funny enough, for some reason. Yeah. We've covered that.
Just looking on the top of the back seat, they've got Yowza on there.
I think that's probably a Welsh expression.
Yeah, yeah. Right, so, yeah. I mean, you know, here you're producing the Man Band.
You're
probably going out... sort of on the road. And well, what, yes, other bands would you have been associated with at that time?
I don't know quite how it came about, but I got involved with the Groundhogs, and they had an album out which had come out called Solid. I wasn't involved in the album, but I went out on the road with them, which I'd done a little bit of on the road stuff with the Man Band to help with stuff, but mainly just sort of being, you know, the producer standing behind the desk seeing how it's done. But got myself into that situation, and the Groundhogs said, well, would you like to come on the road with us and do our sound, which I did, and that was I did a couple of gigs with them around the country, and that was an interesting experience because it's different being behind a sound desk in a huge hall than it is from being in a, you know, actually a fairly dumb studio. And that then took me on a course to a little later on my career, because at the same time I was still in the studio, and in fact from my days with the Who studio in Battersea, I'd met up with a band called the Three Man Army 2. Two of the guys in that band were the Gervitz brothers, and they went on to form Baker Gervitz Army with Ginger Baker drumming. And I got involved again with them, did several albums with them, and very much as a kind of co-producer, mainly from the musical point of view. I used to sing, and again, when I went on the road with them, I'd sit behind the desk, and I don't think it had ever been done before, with a guitar plugged into the desk and with the headphones on and a microphone on the headphones, where I'd sing the high harmonies which I'd sung on the album. And when the guitarist went into his lead guitar bit, I'd whip in and play the rhythm just to beef it all up. And that was fun. I enjoyed that. But as I mentioned to you just now when we were off air, the trouble was that having done that, when I came back and went back to United Artists particularly, they'd all changed. They said, who are you? And And so, I mean, that was...
So you had to go running back to the
No, I can't remember exactly how it came about. They were, they were still there and involved, but with the Baker Gurwitz Army, I was with them for a couple of years, and the second album, Elysian Encounter, which was, it means basically meeting some rather nice piece of totty. But Ginger and I pored for hours over dictionaries trying to work out, you know, another word for...
For totty.
For love, oh, I think it was. Oh, yeah, Elysian. Right, no, that's what that stands for, Elysian Encounter. Yeah. And on the album, anyway, there's some drawings. Joe Patagno, I think it was, that did those.
And he also did quite a lot of the Hawkwind.
He'd come from that same stable. Yeah. But, that second album, there's a... one of the images on it is of the dreamer.
Yeah.
And for some reason, it's me. And there we are.
You're having a quiet sleep, aren't you?
Well known for that.
And we're going to play the track The Dreamer, aren't we?
Yeah, which is on Baker Gurwitz Army's second album. Good band. I mean, their music was great. The Dreamer.
Yeah. Which was your song then?
Well, sort of. I mean, it was written. I didn't write it. It was written by Adrian Gurwitz, who was in fact an incredibly good guitar player. He'd played with B.B. King and all sorts of people like that. Yeah, as a sort of backing guitarist, and went on to the state. Live in the States. I think he's still there. And he did have a hit single over here. It was about living in a bedsit or something. It was quite sweet. Yeah, but I met Graham Edge and did
From the Moody Blues.
From the Moody Blues, and he and Ginger were sort of mates, and we did an album called Kick Off Your Muddy Boots, which was quite that was a fun album.
A couple of weeks ago, Dr. Ben Psychedelic, he played was it Timothy Leary's Dead from the Moody Blues, and it just sounded great on 10 Radio.
Yeah.
I hadn't heard it for years and years, and I don't know what Dr. Ben had done to it, whether he'd sprinkled some fairy dust or whatever, but it just sounded so fresh and everything.
Yeah, amazing,
you know?
Yeah. Well, the music's, music can do that, can't you? Yeah. It's lovely that so much music can actually sound fresh. And for me, I haven't listened to some of these for a long time, and so it's quite exciting for me to hear them afresh. Thank you, Eddie, for having me on the show.
Thank you, Anton.
Really enjoyed it so far. I could bang on all night. I tell you, I expect I've brought people to...
Come back then,
part two
yes.
Super. Okay,
because we haven't mentioned the Stones, and we're going to mention the Stones in a few minutes, but we're now going to go to Steve Gibbons' band.
Great band, I mean, and still on the road, and they had a hit single from the album was called Rolling On. Again, some great tracks on that, and they had a hit single called Tulane, which I think we're going to hear now, aren't we, Eddie?
Yeah.
Far away.
Yeah, this is Tulane by the Steve Gibbons Band.
Good rock record. A good hit single, that, and
it gave Chuck Berry a a little bit of money, I suppose.
I guess so, yes. I'm surprised he wasn't knocking on the door, because apparently he always used to insist he got paid in cash before he'd even pick up his guitar, open the box. Yeah. That was the story I heard on him anyway. So that was my one claim to fame. The only other claim to fame that's in Paul Gambaccini's book was Blame It on the Pony Express by Johnny Johnson and the Bandwagon. That was when I was back at Olympic. Tony McCauley produced that, and of course I didn't know at the time, what an idiot, that Johnny Johnson was the pianist with Chuck Berry, I think.
All right, yeah.
I think I'm right.
I think he was on the CBS label, or Direction label.
Yeah, it could
like
be, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Brilliant. Chuck Berry piano playing. It knocks me out every time. Yeah. Fantastic.
Yeah. One of Dean's questions was about songwriters and that sort of thing, you know, like the people in the 60s and 70s.
Who were the... Well, he's asked the question, who's the real musical geniuses of the 60s? I think it's in the singular. It has to be the Beatles, doesn't it? I mean, they changed so much. And again, that ties in a bit with what I was saying earlier about the whole, you know, everything was at such an experimental time. There was huge technological changes. I mean, it was the beginning of technological change happening so fast you never catch up with yourself. But certainly, I think the Beatles just had to be, you know, one of the biggest influences. Mm. And yes, I mean, there were a huge number of, as Dean, again, he said, well, he kind of asked the question, why have so many people from that time remained so popular? Well, they were good musical people. I'm not sure I entirely agree that they were necessarily unsurpassed, because I have to say I think that this quality of songwriting today with some people is incredibly good. And of course, what's sad, and I experience this as well, that bands you'd work with and have huge respect for because they were so brilliant musically, they never even got their albums released. I mean, I worked on quite a number of those too. It's interesting.
Well, we'll have to look at your secret stash of unreleased albums.
I don't know. I wish I had some of them. I really do. Yeah. And
of course, you worked with the Stones as well, didn't you?
When I first joined Olympic Sound. I mean, I was fairly quickly thrown in, you know. And again, that's how I got to work with Glyn Johns quite a lot on various things. There was one particular magic moment I remember. The Stones used to come in every night, you know, and
they were only little lads. I mean, they weren't too old.
No, I guess not. No, we were all quite young then, Eddie. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, they're some of them are slightly older than me, I guess. Yeah. But and amazing, still going strong. How do we do it?
How does Ten Radio do it? We've been going strong for 3 weeks.
Yeah, the magic moment. Was in the studio, and they were faffing around. They'd been trying out a few licks on this, that, and the other. And there was a separate little sound booth with a microphone, which usually the singer when singing. But Jimmy Miller, who was the producer at the time, American guy, went down into the studio, and he picked up the cowbell. And this isn't a very good cowbell, but he went. And the band came in, and that was the start of Brown Sugar. Right. And fortunately, I'd hit the record button just in time. Yeah. I felt that magic moment, and that was the track that was we all know and love.
Yeah, yeah.
And yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And because you
Brown
were there,
Sugar, that's right. That's sorry. Right.
And you were there, and
Honky Tonk Woman was the other track that I remember being on, because I remember the girls again, some terrific singers, Madeline Bell, Lisa Strike, wonderful singers, wonderful. Ladies, they always brought fun to the party.
I even think Nanette Newman.
That's it, and Nanette Newman. They always used to bring fun to the party. Mm. You know, we all enjoyed it when the girls came and did their bit. But I remember them in Honky Tonk Women working out how, when in the chorus he goes, Honky Tonk Women, and somehow or other the chorus of the girls sings it, but just slightly delayed. It's like an echo almost, but it's a magic moment in it. A magic moment. Great times.
I mean, you were there when history was being written.
In a way, yes. It's a real sort of tingly feeling whenever I hear. I mean, you know, we all like those tracks, but it's a tingly feeling to think I was there when they were done. Yeah, yeah.
Well,
amazing.
I mean, I'd like to say that it's not only the people who wrote these things, but it's all the people behind it. You know, people who maybe added to the arrangements, but also the team of people who basically recorded it, you know, using whatever equipment was available, whether it be 4-track, 8-track, 30, you know, whatever, you know, 32, whatever. I would like to think it's like the care and attention that people like yourself applied to the trade of putting all these sounds down, and you know, and it's testament to the the quality of everything, really, that, you know, you can hear these things being played time and time again. I mean, sounds of the 60s, sometimes you hear things from, like, 1960, whatever.
Yeah.
That's how many years?
Yeah.
40-odd years?
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
And some great...
And it still sounds fresh.
Absolutely.
It was done yesterday.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, maybe yes, maybe there's something about that kind of analog sound, which is what it was then.
Sound, yeah.
It's the analog sound that has that has the longevity.
Yeah.
Great
yeah.
praise of that. Anyway,
the tune. I can feel it closing in on us, and it's only meant to be open for 2 hours. So I think we are going to go out with, well, a song which you say is one of your favourite Who tracks, and it's also one of mine, actually, and it's Won't Get Fooled Again.
Great. There's a wonderful philosophy in this, which I love. It's one of the best.
And it's something about Teenage Wasteland as well, isn't it? I think.
Yeah.
Possibly, yeah. I think that's in
that
there.
Comes in there somewhere. Yeah.
We talked about songwriters. I mean, yes, the Beatles, between them, but you've got Pete Townsend, who wrote some. Well, and he still is.
Yeah.
You know.
Oh, that reminds me, Eddie. It was mentioned that I'd worked a lot with Paul McCartney, and I have to say, I only had a one-night stand with Paul McCartney.
Right.
It was one afternoon and evening's work.
I think
work.
You're safe then in the divorce thing.
Nice bloke. So were the others.
Yeah. Okay, so we're going to go. Well, can I say thank you very much, Anton?
And, well, thank you, Eddie.
For coming into our tomb here. And, you never know. We'll open it up again, Nick.
Forward to that very much, Eddie.
Yeah,
thank you.
Thank you. The Who and Won't Get Fooled Again.
Thank you.
You're listening to 105.3 FM.
The best thing about 10 Radio is that it allows people from all walks of life to have a go at becoming a DJ. Take me, for example. I'm an astronaut.
10 Radio is good because everyone's allowed to join in.
Well, it's great. It has a way of bringing people together, and it's a lot of fun.
10 Radio is good because you don't know what to say.
I really like the fact that 10 Radio gives everybody the chance to go out there and just be what they want to be. 10 Radio is brilliant for that.
The best thing about 10 Radio is that it keeps the 10 parishes informed about all interested events taking place.
It's a privilege to broadcast to the community.
Everything's brilliant about 10 Radio. The best thing about 10 Radio is that it's just so easy to get involved.
10 Radio is great because it is one big rollercoaster ride.
10 Radio is great because it brings a voice to the community.
The best thing about 10 Radio is it's a chance for everybody to get involved. Whoever they are, wherever they're from, just go for it.
And the best thing about 10 Radio is how it brings the whole community together and gets everyone talking, young and old, and all different races, really. It's just fantastic.
One of the presenters said to me, it was like a drug. I have to admit, I'm hooked, and so will you be.
10 Radio is really good, so you can say as many W's as you like. www.10
Radio.